I would like to start by expressing my deepest respect and gratitude to the many Indigenous peoples and tribal nations in the Coast Salish Sea region for their enduring care and protection of our shared lands and waterways. Thank you so much for joining me today for episode 21 of the Northwest Fish Passage podcast. Northwest Fish Passage is a small, strategic, collaborative partnership of engineers, planners, and scientists who are passionate about habitat restoration in the Salish Sea region. Today, I'm honored to be talking to Raina Priest. She is a Washington State Poet Laureate. I had the great honor of hearing her speak in spring 2023 at the Salmon Recovery Conference in Washington State. My employees gave me an amazing book of poems that were compiled by her called I Sing the Salmon Home, and that will be in the show notes. Raina, thank you so much for joining me today for this podcast.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for the invitation.
Where did you grow up? And also, can you tell me about the first fish you caught?
Yeah, so I grew up on the Lummi Reservation, and I think probably the first fish I caught was my grandmother's goldfish. my brother tells the story, or he used to tell the story of me reaching in and grabbing this goldfish and him chasing me down the hall yelling, "Raina, no!" And by the time he caught me, it was too late for the goldfish, which is really sad. But that was the first.
How old were you?
I think I must have been probably about two or three.
Oh, okay. Goldfish killer.
I know, yeah.
Well, you were so young. You were just trying to help the goldfish, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, like I mentioned in the intro, I first heard you speak at the Salmon Recovery Conference, and I'd love for you to tell me a little bit about what salmon means for you.
Lummi is a fishing culture, and salmon are sacred. So they're a keystone species, and I think the ancestors recognized that. Our existence was so reliant upon the salmon runs. And there's a whole cosmology around the reef net. It was a technology invented by the Lummi people, my people, my tribe. We were originally Straits Salish, so we lived in the islands, you know, throughout the San Juan Island and that whole ecosystem. So salmon are sacred, and to me, as a beneficiary of the fishery. My dad was a fisherman. Actually, he just retired a few years ago. Actually, this year. Wow. No, last year. It's 2024 now. Sold his last boat and retired at the age of 80. But lifelong, you know, I think his mother taught him how to stake fish in Bellingham Bay. And then he bought a gill netter and then a purse seiner and, you know, made a whole career out of it. And then after the fishery disaster happened in the 90s, he got out of the business and started retraining fishers as the tribal employment rights officer. So I guess some retraining, but just, you know, finding alternative work or trying to expand opportunities for tribal members working in our community. Yeah. I think that's probably it.
Thanks for sharing about what it means to you and also sharing about your father. I just moved to Bellingham 4 years ago. And so I'm just learning about the community and the local tribes. I grew up in Seattle, and I used to do some volunteer events with the Duwamish tribe there in Seattle. Plantings along the Duwamish River for about 5 years. What inspired you to compile the book of poems called I Sing the Salmon?
I Sing the Salmon Home?
I Sing the Salmon Home, yes.
I was invited to be a co-editor on an anthology about orcas. And at the time, I was just way too busy. And I remember one of the other editors, the one who was talking to me about it, asking me, well, what would your dream project be? And I said, I would like to do a salmon anthology because, you know, the orcas are an indicator species, which means that they tell us how well we're doing overall, and which not that great. You know, they're kind of the southern residents are on the brink of, well, they're at risk, right? And so while they're an indicator species, I said salmon are a keystone species and everything in the ecosystem relies on them. And I feel like we should just really celebrate them and make people love them the way that I love, the way that I love them, the way that, you know, Coast Salish people, we hold them dear and sacred. And I don't want to sound like woo-woo about it or new agey about it or anything, because it's actually quite deep. And when I say we hold them sacred, like our survival depends on them. And even spiritually, our spirit depends on them. They're an example. I mean, the only way that I can compare is if there are people, you know, the way that I think Christians hold their Jesus sacred, we hold the salmon sacred in this way. Is maybe how I
am. Oh, that's beautiful. I really appreciate you sharing that. I, growing up in Seattle, I've always appreciated salmon, and where, you know, I came from a background of a Christian family, and it's really, and as I like to meet new people, I love to hear their stories, and I also just love to hear about different perspectives. And so I really appreciate hearing your perspective today and sharing so much of yourself. Really appreciate it.
And I guess I can't speak for all. I mean, like, I won't speak for all Coast Salish.
Right.
This is the culture that I grew up in and how I was taught and the background that I'm coming from. And also I should say that the fishing disasters, they didn't happen because of overfishing by tribes. I need to make that explicit.
Yes. Because
sometimes people assume when I'm writing about overfishing, I'm talking about tribes. I'm not. It's the largest salmon cannery in the world was in Bellingham in the 1800s. Tin makers couldn't even keep up with the amount of salmon being harvested by fish traps owned by the canneries. And so they had this practice of taking all the unprocessed salmon and putting it on a barge and shipping it out into the middle of the bay so that it wouldn't stink, because they initially were just dumping the unprocessed salmon into the bay and they'd wash up on the beaches, and it was kind of causing, I guess, public concern. So they bought barges to just pile the salmon on in mountains and then, you know, push it out into the bay until they rotted and then they could bring the barge back. So that kind of thing would happen while lummy fishers were prohibited from being on the water. It was illegal for, you know, the nets were confiscated, canoes were confiscated. Children were removed from families because the fishers were deemed criminal, poachers, things of that nature. And so women went to work in the canneries and relied on government rations at the time, which is just outrageous, right? Mm-hmm. To know that this abundance was being harvested in my homelands and wasted and abused the way that it was, to where now a lot of the fishery is on the brink of collapse. And so just to make it clear, it wasn't tribal fishers. The reef net was designed to be sustainable so that there's a hole at the top, so that, and they always pulled from the middle of the catch. And so the ones going out front got through and the ones at the back got through because the net had been lifted out of the water. And so, you know, it acknowledged the need to not overharvest, essentially. And the reef nets were the inspiration for the fish traps that the canneries put out throughout the bay, throughout the Salish Sea, actually. The cannery owners, that, you know, I guess capitalists, didn't like the reliance on community participation that the reef nets symbolized. It was like, you know, you have to pay all these men, and you have to, you know, it was not to them a good model for profit. And so they looked at the technology and how it was built, and then they made the fish traps so that they didn't have to be manned by anybody, and they could just simply harvest fish all day every day and like pull it in and and process it what they could before it spoiled.
I really appreciate you sharing that. I thought about that question just a minute before you started talking about the reef net, so you must have read my mind. But I really appreciate you saying that. I for one never thought that, because I grew up in a pretty progressive family in Seattle. But yeah, I think I'm glad you brought it up, because it's important for everybody to know the history. Were those canneries, was it Birch Bay that or up there that had the biggest ones, or were they in Bellingham?
They were throughout the region, but the largest one that I mentioned, it was in Fairhaven, you know where Taylor Dock is, and that big, yes. It looks like a rock. That's not a rock. That is, every time a can of fish was sealed, a drop from the aluminum would drop down into the water, and it just accumulated so that it's like this huge boulder. That's they call it the tin meteor, because it's so massive, and it just comes from, like, you know, one little drop of aluminum falling off, trickling down after each can was sealed. And so that's a symbol of like just how much fish was run through there.
And is that the right, or the, that aluminum, is that the, there's the woman dancing on the, is she on top of that in the,
yeah.
Okay. I know what you're talking. Yeah, I had read, they do have a nice little sign up there. I remember reading about it, like an info sign at Boulevard Park. My next question, I may have also got this confused with one of the other poets, but I recall that in the introduction, you had a sentence or two talking about the circle as being an image for thinking or writing about salmon. Is that something that you can expand on?
I think that's not in my intro,
okay.
But I have a poem called A Salmon is a Song Sung in Rhyme.
Okay.
And that one is talking about their cycle, their journey, you know, kind of being like the hero's journey, where it starts out. I didn't know this before collecting this anthology, but when they go downstream, they look, they're facing where they're coming from, so that I think, presume, so that they can get back that way. That is a good metaphor that I've used, not only in the poem, in speaking about salmon and how important that journey is and that circle, like that they be allowed to complete that circle naturally, I think is crucial to all the species that rely on them, including the ecosystem itself, you know, like the trees, the marine derived nutrients.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
The way that they go out to the ocean to bring all of that nutrition back upstream, I'm told, is why, like, the Napa Valley, the Columbia River Valley, that it's so fertile, is from thousands of generations of salmon coming back and spawning. Their bodies are completely absorbed into the ecosystem, the surrounding ecosystem, and with it, all of the gifts of the ocean that they've collected and brought back in their flesh, which is quite beautiful. So they're completing the circle.
Yeah.
That journey is a blessing for everything.
Thank you. As a scientist and engineer, I sometimes struggle with explaining complicated information clearly. And do you have any advice for how scientists and engineers can close that gap in communication?
Well, I think that I wouldn't necessarily, I don't think I would presume to tell scientists how to communicate.
Okay.
I will tell a story, though. I did give a workshop, like I was part of a like 3-day long gathering of salmon scientists in Vancouver, or in Musqueam homelands. And I remember just kind of after I got up and started talking and I was reading poems, and there were just like stony faces, just blank stares and crickets in the room, right? And so I finally just said, you know, you guys are a tough audience, because I'm used to reading to, you know, poets and things like that. And they always emote, like, you, and they laugh, and you, you know, or you say something sad and they go, oh, you know, it's always like a response, or like you can see people shaking their heads or smiling, or, you know, just kind of responding to you. And it was like, nothing. I was getting nothing off these salmon scientists. So I called them out. I said, I'm going to tell the other poets about you guys. And then they kind of chuckled. And then during the break, a few of them came up and said, you know, we really did like what you were sharing. We have to think about it for a long time before we respond. That is a part of a, like, it, that the work being done by salmon scientists is, it's they're fact finding. They're on these missions to kind of understand the truth and find facts and information to be able to like give to people to say, look, this is actually what's happening here. And then I think the expectation is, because they're approaching it with such like a reasonable mind, the expectation is that it'll be received reasonably and with the gravitas that it deserves. But people don't, we don't really work that way, right? The reason that I opened the book with the poem that I did is that line, poor salmon scientists here's poor salmon scientists with a poem with a handful of numbers and nothing but data to howl with. I think,
yes, I love that.
I love that line so much. And that's by Rob Lewis, his poem. But I opened with that because I feel like it is it's a problem. Like, we will never know the actual situation that we're in if it doesn't find its way into, you know, popular culture somehow. You know, and not to say that poetry is popular culture, because I recognize it's very niche. But there are a lot of people who read poetry and love poetry. And I was just stunned by the amount of submissions that I got to the anthology. I thought, oh, you know, there's not that much time to put it together between August and October. I'll put a call out for submissions, because that's all the time that I had within the grant that I was working with, if I was going to be able to organize it and publish it before the end of my laureateship. And so I put the call out in August, and I thought, maybe I'll get 100 submissions. Mm-hmm. I got over 300 poets submitted over 700 poems.
Wow.
I know. And I was just blown away. I was like, wow, this is really, you know, and it was so hard to choose, because the quality of the work was always just outstanding. Like, people really care and put their hearts and like emotions and passions all over this, right? Like, this is something that people in Washington State really recognize mm-hmm. is valuable, and people feel passionate about it. And the poetry that I got wasn't all from poets. It was from scientists. Mm-hmm. It was from, you know, people in real estate, people in like the film industry. It's just like all different walks of life sending these poems, and all different ages. And so that was really exciting to see that this is an issue that people care about, and it perhaps doesn't get the kind of attention or space in the media that it deserves.
I appreciate you sharing that. Do you think you would make a, have you thought about doing a follow-up, a second book, since you have so many poems that you receive?
There was talk at the publisher about putting some of the ones that we couldn't publish into like onto a website. But that again would be kind of the resources of mm-hmm. available to like a publisher. I am, now that I'm no longer in that position doing like public service, I'm a poet again. Yeah. I'm a writer. So that kind of takes up a lot of my time and my energy and my focus. And while I do enjoy that work of like editing and collecting other people's work, mm-hmm. it's been really nice to be focusing on my own.
I was going to ask you, about what your most recent book of poetry is called and where we could, the viewers and I could get that?
Yeah, so I'm actually in the final process of editing my new collection of poems, and it's called Dancing to the Ticking of the Doomsday Clock. And it will be out hopefully in November, but I'm thinking of compiling a chapbook, something small that I can, you know, create by hand, like arts chapbooks, kind of. I used to hand build these books and hand sew the spine and sell them at readings. And that's something I haven't done in a long time, but I have some workshops and things coming up in the summer that I think it's too bad that the book won't be available by then, but I can maybe have enough of these small like preview collections on hand to be able to offer to people. So
what was the last one before I sing the salmon home that I know you have a lot of ones that you've published. So I'm just curious, what was the one most recently published of your poetry?
So I actually haven't published poetry since 2018, other than in a small book about beaches, which is a nonfiction. It's kind of like a little tour guide
book. I read about it last night and I want to pick it up. Where do you recommend buying it?
I think Village Books probably has that one. It's on Sasquatch Books, which is a subsidiary of, they're like a regional arm of Penguin Random House. So their distribution is really good. So if it's not in bookstores, you can definitely order it. It's part of a series. It's called the Northwest Know-How series. Mm-hmm. And so the first one was Northwest Know-How Beer, then Northwest Know-How Trees, then Northwest Know-How Beaches. And so it might not be as readily available like on shelves. New one is out. It's called Northwest Know-How Hauntings. So like haunted places in the Pacific Northwest. That's kind of the one out right now. But if you request it, they'll definitely be able to order it from just about anywhere.
Great. Yeah, I was really excited to read the little blurb about it last night.
Yeah. And I always tell people, if you order online, order through the Village Books website. Not Amazon, because you can go to Village Books and they can send you any book. Like, it's really great, just like Amazon, but Village Books. So
yeah, and that's for those of you not in Bellingham. That's a big, amazing bookstore, independent bookstore here in Bellingham.
So beloved.
Yeah,
such an important part of our community.
And it's been so fun talking to you. I know we both have a lot of things to do this afternoon. But before we close, I wanted to ask you what you are most hopeful about and any closing statements that you'd like, or poetry that you'd like to share.
Yeah, I guess I'm most hopeful about a shift in focus towards habitat restoration, rather than thinking that hatcheries be answer. I'm most excited about like the science really looking at that now, because I feel hatcheries were a capitalistic endeavor, right? They're not, they never really studied the efficacy of hatcheries before implementing them widely and saying, look, you know, farmers of the sea, like this is, you know, we'll just do it like agriculture. And so they did that, and thinking, you know, it'll just replace all of the salmon that are harvested. But what has happened is they're not as strong. Those runs are not as strong coming back. They don't come back. And I mean, if you think about like the salmon's journey that I was talking about earlier, and how they look upstream when they're going downstream, they're looking at where they came, and they're absorbing all of the they find them their way home through olfactory senses, through the sense of smell. And so they're absorbing all of that information about their natal stream as they go out to the ocean. And, you know, when they get there, if they've just been going around in a circle in a hatchery for, you know, months and months and months until they get released out into the ocean, they're not going to have that awareness of how to get home and how to be the gift that they're meant to be to the ecosystem. And so scientists have started to look at it, but it is like a multi-billion dollar industry worldwide. They pump over 5 billion fish hatcheries, pump over 5 billion salmon into the ecosystem every year to compete with wild salmon around the Pacific Rim. The science is, I think, probably struggling to be heard or funded in the way that it needs to be. So I guess I'm most excited about the possibility that people recognize the need to actually take that seriously and look at whether or not investing in hatcheries to the level that we have is detrimental to salmon runs, and maybe shifting gears and shifting focus towards a more habitat restoration based form of preservation.
Thank you.
That's
I appreciate you describing that so eloquently. I am excited. That's something I'm excited about too, but I don't know that I could describe it quite as clear and concise as you did. So thank you.
Thank you.
And as a lot of people know, I have been doing habitat restoration as a career for the last 20 years. And I have a little women-owned business in Bellingham for the last 8 years. And I am definitely motivated by the salmon, and I am motivated by improving the environment. And it really is upsetting to hear the history. It's disturbing that I grew up in Seattle, but I was never taught really the history of the area. What really was, I knew some stuff, you know, from Europe.
A lot of people were not, you know, in fact, like I read an article in the New Yorker of all places about, you know, kind of how the fishing industry drove, like commercial fishing industry drove the fishery towards the state that it's in right now, right? Like to collapse in many parts of the world. And it started in the 1800s with Thomas Henry Huxley at like an international fisheries convention. And he was asked the question, do you think that like these implementations, these like new technologies that we're talking about here are detrimental to the fishery? And his answer as the president of the Royal Society of the at the time was something like, the abundance of the ocean cannot be extirpated by the agency of man, something like that. Like,
oh,
no,
beautiful.
Essentially, yeah. Like we cannot, nothing that people can do can disrupt the abundance of the ocean, right? Is kind of was his answer. So that really in the 1800s blew open the doors for like these really destructive fishing practices.
Yeah, I see.
Tanneries and things like that. And so Bellingham's School of Environmental Science here at Western Washington University for many years, it was called Huxley School of Environmental Science after Thomas Henry Huxley. And I'm thinking, why was that? Oh, because the largest cannery in the world was in Bellingham. And so, you know, like if you follow the money, he's really the benefactor. probably.
Oh,
like,
how ironic. And yeah.
And so they changed the name. I'm not sure to what they took it.
Yeah,
name.
The school, College of the Environment. I went to Western in the 90s and I graduated in 1997 from Huxley College. And yeah, I didn't know that. I knew kind of bits and pieces of it, but I think you summarized it really well in terms of what the why it can't be the name of a environmental science college. And really, yeah.
And so, probably why it actually was named after him.
Oh, yes, exactly. yeah, it's a good point.
Yeah. But
I really appreciate you taking so much time to talk to me today.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for inviting me anytime. I appreciate the work that you're doing with your podcast.
Thank you. Thank you so much for listening today. If you enjoyed this podcast, please share with a friend and write a review. Have a great day.